Blog Talk Radio.
The child support hustle is real. Bringing voices to power. HuntStillBlack.com. They can't stop us.
In this episode of United Voices, hosted by Sherry Saunders and Deanna Look, they discuss mental illness and psychoactive drugs. Many friends and loved ones have suffered from some form of mental disorder. Sherry has seen it and dealt with it, helping the homeless. Deanna used to manage two recovery houses for women in Montgomery, Alabama, and had women sent to her from Juliet, Utah, straight from the street, and some came in with ankle monitors from correctional departments. Deanna can attest to what happens when taking pharmaceutical drugs for mental disorders. Sherry and Deanna have recently teamed up with Green Cross and manages the branch in Alabama. They will discuss that as well.
Good evening, everybody. Deanna, are you on?
I am on.
Do we have anybody else on the line right now that would like to announce themselves?
I'm on. Daniel Kaysen.
Hey, Daniel.
Okay,
hey.
We've got a new caller. New caller, can you announce yourself?
My name is Daniel Kaysen.
Okay, Daniel, we hear you. We've got a new caller. New caller, who are you coming in from?
Hi, this is Nobia Monterey. I'm calling from California.
Hey, Nobia, how are you doing this evening?
Very good, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, well, we're happy to have you on. We've got Deanna Look and Daniel Kaysen. Daniel Kaysen is my assistant. He has worked with me for close to 6 months through some nonprofit work in homeless issues and activism for the environment. Deanna Look, her record speaks for itself. What I'm going to do, ladies, is let you two take this show. Daniel, let's let the experts in the field talk, and when we have a break, if you'd like to ask a question, Daniel, certainly. If there's any of the callers that comes in on the line, if you'd like to ask any questions, just let us know. So, ladies, take it away.
Deanna, I'm going to defer to you first.
Okay. Nobi, I'm really interested in hearing what you have to say to us today. I'm really honored that you're on the show with us. I'm going to have Sherry Saunders revert to the questions because she seems to be better at that than I am. However, I do want to give a background of my education. I actually first sought out a degree in ministerial counseling just to manage the recovery houses for women that I did manage in the city of Montgomery, Alabama. I later sought out a bachelor's of science for the major of psychology, minoring in criminal justice. However, I have not completed that degree as we speak. I did graduate my first degree, 3.9 GPA, so I feel I'm pretty confident in this. Yes, ma'am, and also, you know, the fact that I was honored to be able to speak on these women's behalf that I used to, when I managed these recovery homes, to judges, to parole officers. I did have to perform the 12-panel drug testing. I watched all of the, you know, the actions of people who took, you know, cocaine, amphetamines, opiates, alcohol, you know, benzos, barbiturates, all of the things that you could possibly imagine. I watched these things turn their lives upside down into a shambles, and it was my job to try to get them back on track. So that's all I wanted to say about that. I would like to assert myself, you know, wherever is necessary, but I'm really interested in hearing you speak, Novia, so you take the floor.
Oh, well, thank you. And I think that is a really good place to start on the intros. I myself went back to college, really to answer a calling. The first was I had cancer, and they didn't stage in those days. I was not even 30 yet when I had it, and two children. I didn't think I was going to live, so spent many years just thinking about how to be a good mom to them in the event that they had to live without me. And then once I realized I was going to live, I went back to school, and I felt like I was answering a calling too, as you did. And I did start with a psychology degree, and then I converted it to a teaching degree because I felt like where it was being missed was in school.
Hey,
where
hey Novia, I hate to interrupt. We're getting a new caller.
Sure.
New caller, please announce yourself. Novia, we'll get right back to you. New caller,
sure.
Please announce yourself. Okay, it looks like the caller wants to stay quiet. Novia, please continue.
Sure. So I realized that where things are going undiagnosed and where we could really have early intervention is in school. So I switched my major to a teaching with a master's in special education. But I kind of got caught up in that, you know, loss of jobs in California. And I was really policy-driven. I really realized, you know, what we need to change is public policy. We have a public policy crisis here with mental health, with overprescribing children drugs when they're young. Ritalin is a killer.
Oh, yeah.
And many learning issues are being misdiagnosed as ADHD. And really what we have is a world of diverse thinkers, feelers, people that move differently in the world. And, you know, they say 25% of mental illness at some point in somebody's life will be addressed. But I believe it's much greater than that. I believe what we really are is we're all different, diverse human beings. We all have something different to bring to this world. And there's times that we are not addressing our mental health. And we get a little sick. I've been sick before. We all get sick. We all have different severities of illnesses within our emotional state. But I really believe after going through as much as I did with family members and as a special ed assistant, I really saw kids that were young that were being misdiagnosed. And I just knew this is a much bigger problem. And then, of course, I went on to law school after that because I thought, well, okay, public policy, that's how you handle that, is you affect public policy by suing to change laws. And it's not a monetary type of a suit, really. What we're really talking about is you go in and you say, you make an injunction to say, this has got to change. We've got to do something different to address this problem. And I went very strongly into the cannabis activism because it also appeared at the time that we were not addressing other issues like cancer and mental health with cannabis, PTSD with cannabis. We had a slew of vets that were returning from Afghanistan and Iraq with bags of medication that they had to take. So it all kind of evolved into this activism with cannabis because now I think we can all agree cannabis cures just about everything, doesn't it?
Sure.
It cures it can cure mental health issues if you're looking at the root of the problem and you're treating the root of the problem with therapy. And if therapy is not going to work, I think people have to do is they have to go within, look at their triggers, and then use something like cannabis or even psychoactive drugs such as MDMT, MDMA, DMT, mushrooms, psilocybin, that is, LSD. And I think that with Obama signaling cannabis rather than being treated, should be used as a mental health issue because there's some medicinal value. We can use cannabis to treat certain mental health issues. So
right.
I think it all comes full circle, doesn't it?
Yeah, I feel like that there is an importance in the separation of Schedule One drugs. You know, heroin is known to be a killer. You know, methamphetamines are known to be a killer. LSD sometimes has killed, you know, in overdoses. Marijuana, however, has no deaths ever. And it has been proven to be beneficial in the assisting of so many different ailments. You know, I think that that's why it is so important that we focus on removing that as a Schedule One drug.
I agree. And I think that that's helped bring attention to that, at least when I started really kicking up my activism while I was in school and I was trying to get the ban lifted in our local municipality so that we could open up a dispensary. My partner and I at the time were meeting more and more and more vets who were coming back from Iraq, coming back from Afghanistan with a bag full of pills, and it was making them more sick.
Right.
And many more of them were dumping the bag of pills and doing the cannabis, and then they were starting to get in trouble because they were being screened for cannabis.
Right. Yes.
And then that drives the activism because then people are feel like their right to treat their own health with a natural plant is being violated when they know what works. And that brings us back to cannabis. And my own family members who've had a variety of different mental health issues, and cannabis provided relief without terrible side effects. And I
right.
think that's the other thing that we have to look at is some of these psychotropics that are being prescribed to people have terrible side effects. And in fact, many of them cannot be used over a long period of time. And that's probably the biggest problem that we're seeing, I believe, is where people are starting to get liver issues and kidney problems because it's filling their system with these chemicals that are not natural to their system, where with cannabis we have the receptors and we know how to process cannabis. Our body already knows it's in our DNA.
Right.
Questions that when it Novi, when you're talking about mental health from the military's point of view, I was an active duty member of the United States Army Reserves. I was a combat medic. When I served my country, I was in Central America during the 90s. So I did not get to see any of the excitement of the Gulf War. And for that matter, I didn't have much to complain about. I had an easy deployment. Excuse me for coughing. But let me say this on behalf of the veterans. When you go into the military, you are encouraged to never, ever ask for help. You are encouraged to understand that you have a right to go speak to a chaplain, and that it is probably in your best interest to go speak to the chaplain instead of going to the doctor and explaining why you cannot sleep, or why you cannot wake up, or why you cannot eat, or why you cannot stop thinking about your buddy whose head just got exploded in the foxhole next to you. So
right.
It is an environment of isolationism. And if you are in the military and you are having problems, you understand that if you want to continue with your career, that you will keep those problems to yourself until you can't until it impacts your family and then it impacts your children. Then DHR gets involved. Then the post gets involved. Then you get kicked out of the military. Your family doesn't have a way to support itself. And things spiral out of control. Now, one other aspect that Nobia is correct on is the prescribed medicines that they would rather give a soldier to keep them numb and dumb than to allow for that person to heal from the injury, be it emotional, be it physical, be it both. They would rather keep you peeled to death. Those have to do with a lot of contracts with the pharmaceutical companies and who's getting paid. A lot of things go into play when it comes down to pharmaceuticals. The one thing is understood. That is that our government does not care enough about us to give us the one product on this market, cannabis, that the government itself holds a patent for its medicinal uses in the human being. So how can it be that it is both illegal due to its criminal use, while at the same time, its therapeutic use has a patent and the United States government's name on it. Now, Deanna, you worked in a capacity where you got to experience the justice system. Can you expound on what happened and what would happen to these ladies as they would come to you?
Well, I mean, obviously, first and foremost, most of them were already caught up in the justice system anyway. That's why they ended up at my house. And a lot of them were caught up in the justice system with felonies, which means that after their drug arrest, whatever happened, we had prostitutes that would come to us, for instance. You know, they didn't prostitute because this was something that they set out to do on a daily basis. They didn't love their job. They prostituted because they were drug addicts, and that was their means of getting the next drug. But once they were convicted, at that point, they were busted or selling or whatever they were doing. If they received a felony charge, once they came out of that system, which, by the way, you never get out of that system, but once they were in my care, they couldn't get, minimum wage paying jobs. They couldn't get, they struggled to make ends meet. They were already struggling with their mental health to begin with, but to put all of that pressure on top of them, it was not uncommon for me to see these women go back out. When people are trying to recover from drug addictions, they are already under the pressure of recovering, and that is a grave pressure, mind you. But to add everything else on top of it is almost setting up them a failure system for them to function in. They cannot, overcome. Most of them cannot overcome that.
Well, I think
right.
That's where Nobia has probably a lot to say when it gets to that point on how you set someone up for failure and expect for that person to come out of the hole. Nobia, work with that.
Well, I think the way that I don't know if this is answering your question, but it did trigger a thought of mine. And I think with addiction especially, because all of us have had an experience one way or another with addiction, and it is it's a behavior, it's a pattern, and we lay these neuro pathways. So take that prostitute for example. There's a neuro pathway that has been solidified by behavior, and so much of and then if you and I think that's why you can look at, for heroin addict, for example, where methadone helps. In the beginning, it helps a great deal because you're changing the behaviors. The woman doesn't have to go out and prostitute or steal, or it doesn't matter if it's a woman or a man. They both prostitute. They both steal. They both have addictive behaviors that create neural pathways that it's difficult to change that behavior when it's become a practice, a habit. I mean, it's literally to that definition. It's a habit. And we throw people out there without the proper therapy and then possibly the proper medical course of treatment. You can only use, I believe, methadone for so long. Then you need to probably change over to something like cannabis, because you have to be able to change the pattern, the behavior. And I think that goes for any kind of mental illness. I noticed with myself, so now I'm going to use myself as an example. I have a medically induced bipolar, if you will. They call it bipolar 2 or ADHD. A lot of us could say we were probably ADHD when we were kids, and we also make a big joke about it. But I obviously have a lot of energy, and it's medically induced, and it's just my own manifestation of how I reacted to my thyroid being removed. I don't have a regulator for my hormones, and it just, it hits my nerve system a certain way. It's just how it acts with me. I've talked to doc, I have, you know, a physician. Initially, when I presented the idea to him after 25 years living this way and saying, look, this is the way I was before, and this is the way I am now, A lot of it is habit. So, of course, I cannot help. I have to take the thyroid every day. But what we started doing was adding, Wellbutrin to it, because we were trying to kick the dopamine up. We were trying to kick something up in my system that would get me to feel more normal. And then I had a problem where, after a couple of years of Wellbutrin, changes your brain chemistry. And so you're on this constant challenge to get ahead of the next habit. Does that make sense? So
yes.
I have to go on and off Wellbutrin. It works for a while, but then actually very bad for me. So it's a constant challenge of changing my medication and then working on my habits.
And well, that's an important aspect of psychology just in itself.
Yeah. Exactly.
Deanna, did you have something you wanted to add?
I was just, you know, I'm in complete agreement with what she's saying. Whether the pharmaceutical companies are, and I'm going to say this choke, choke, cough, whether they're knowledgeable of it changing our brain matter, you know, to the level of our chemicals in our brain now learning how to function off of what we are being prescribed or not, whether they're aware of it or not, ha-ha.
Right. And I don't think they are. I mean, I know I had to tell my doctor, and then he said, no, keep taking it. I said, fuck that. Screw that. I'm going to go off of it. I know what's right for my body, and I know it's right for me, but proceed. Exactly. They don't necessarily know what's right.
Yeah, and I'm under the belief that the pharmaceutical companies do know. They may release these pills half-assed, you know, and no studies being done on them. Oh, hey, this is the next greatest thing. Let's go ahead and put you on it. We're going to use you as a guinea pig. But after so many people have come forward and said, hey, you know, this is, you know, something's going wrong here, I'm not understanding what's happening, there comes a point where they know that this is happening. I personally fell victim to clonopin. I went through a situation that created PTSD in myself and actually had me labeled dissociative. Even developing new personalities. So they decided to place me on clonopin in order to remedy the situation. And, of course, you know, and I've heard this from many people who've been on clonopins before, but I didn't hear this until after I started sharing my experience with it, that clonopins have the ability to make you lose your mind. they literally have the ability to make you not realize that you are doing things. Your memory is completely wiped away. And I had to personally be hospitalized just in order to regulate myself in order to get off of those. To the degree that I had laid an entire 10 by 15 square foot hardwood floor and then walked back into it the next day and wondered where my carpet was. So that's how bad that affected me, you know, and when I'm sure that the stories that I have heard from other people who have been placed on Klonopin and their stories being so similar to myself, that you would think that they would have already pulled that from the market, since there's that level of, you know, so many people saying that this is happening to them. But you can still be prescribed Klonopin to this day.
Oh, and Klonopins aren't, that's a benzo, is that correct? And I've witnessed that with my own family members who have heightened anxiety and paranoia, where it can help when they're episodic.
Right.
But I, knowing that the risk of addiction, and I believe Klonopins are the most addictive drug out there. I believe there are some medical, there's some schools of thinking that that is worse than heroin.
Sure.
And I've actually seen it written by people's own personal testimonies, and I want to say Stevie Nicks came forward and said that it was more addictive than, you know, and she had tried a few things, and it was the most addictive thing for her, and yes, she said the same thing. She lost, like, years of her life.
Yes.
To the memory.
Absolutely. I still have memories that I don't remember. I mean, I have people coming to me and talking to me about situations, and I still do not remember them. And it's not just the memories of during that time frame. It erased memories from my past as well. So,
Well, one of the aspects of that drug in particular as to why it is so popular is that within the clinical aspect, if you are, so to speak, in the nut house, you are going to have that drug along with a list of others that you are taking. Oftentimes, it is in the best interest of the hospital or the caregiver that the patient does not remember what happens to him. There are always unexplained injuries or unexplained pregnancies or unexplained lots of things. And so if you are under the influence of a drug that is literally making you a walking zombie, then you are in a position of being abused. And while in that position, anything that does happen to you, you cannot testify against and or for. So that's one of the aspects of mental health that we need to bring into play. Now, Daniel Kaysen is on the line, and I bet Daniel has some things that he would like to speak about when it comes to this. Daniel, do you have any questions or any comments that you'd like to make at this time?
Yes, I was just going to share my story. It's a long story, and I'll kind of make it short, but I had gotten shot a few years ago, and they had me on, you know, Oxycontin, hydrocodone. They had me on different milligrams, morphine. And I'd gotten out of the hospital about 3 weeks after I got shot. Got shot three times, two in the leg, one in the thumb. But, they didn't even taper me down on my pain medicine. They just cut me off. And at the time, I didn't know very much about cannabis. And that actually helped me get off of the pain medicine, helped with the withdrawals, helped me sleep, helped me from keeping tossing and turning. It controlled my hunger. But they were trying to get me to, you know, trying to put me in a mental hospital and stuff, and kept giving me Celexa, and I kept having I knew a lot about Celexa and antidepressants, and I had to sit there and try to hide it from the nurse. So, yeah, I mean, cannabis helps a lot.
So we have a situation, Daniel, that in your case, under clinical care, you decided that they were forcibly trying to medicate you, and it put you in a position where you lied. Is that correct?
It made me vulnerable.
It made you vulnerable. Well, that is that's the position a lot of us are in. Now that the music has come on, Nobia, we've got about 2.5 minutes left. Daniel, I appreciate you coming on and sharing that personal story. Deanna, if you and Nobia want to take out the last 2 minutes, I'd like to invite everybody to come back next week to United Voices. And I appreciate y'all attending today's show. And Nobia and Deanna, y'all take us out.
Okay. You go ahead, Deanna.
I was just going to add to Daniel Tyson's experience when I was being when I was exiting my medical care for, you know, after being taken off of the Klonopins and having to be regulated. The doctor called me into his office and said he found marijuana in my system, and I told him, well, yes, you know, there's going to come a point in your career where you will be prescribing this to your patients. And he just laughed and signed me out. So they know this is coming. You know, marijuana is a very effective use. It has no side effects, you know, especially not the side effects of what these other drugs, the pharmaceutical drugs that are being issued have. It is going to be a very beneficial thing. It is time we stand up and legalize this. It is ridiculous that we're even having to stand up to legalize something that is nature-made.
Exactly, and I agree with everything you said, and I just encourage everybody to stand strong and talk about how cannabis can help, and just I encourage everybody to use cannabis along with their other treatment, and it can be, you know, a sliding scale. Like you said, we should be taking the opiates down and increasing the cannabis because there are no true physical or psychological withdrawals with cannabis like there are with opiates. It's manageable. And just the last note, Timothy Leary was successful in prison inmates reducing recidivism. So if that tells you anything about pot, basically it just calms everybody down.
Well, I have one last.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, you're welcome, Nadia. I'd like to quote this statement I'm looking at. Nearly 70% of Americans are on at least one prescription drug, and more than half take two. The Mayo Clinic and Olmsted Medical Center researchers say antibiotics, antidepressants, and pain-killing opiates are the most commonly prescribed, their study found. A record 4.2 billion drug prescriptions were written in the U.S. in 2011, up from 3.99 billion the year before. According to the journal Chemical Neuroscience, antidepressants such as Zoloft and Celexa were the most prescribed class of drugs in 2011, with 254 million prescriptions filled. That says it all.
That says it all. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Another great show. Peace out.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Bye.
Thanks, Daniel. Thanks for coming on. Nobia, thank you for coming in from California, Deanna, from South Alabama, and Sherry from North Alabama. This is United Voices, produced by Marcus Eccles. We appreciate everybody on the show. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sherry.